call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order.
This is, what is it, 137 on the 20th of February, so welcome. We have Senator Meyer, who's going to present a bill today, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Coghill is the chairman. I know that we have Senator Kelly will be here momentarily. Today, what we're going to do is we're going to take up Senate Bill 20, which is dealing with controlled substances, Senate Bill 6, which is industrial hemp production. The intention is to go ahead and have Senate Bill 20 before us today. We'll take a good look at it. And then my intention is to bring it up again Wednesday. So if you have questions, it's a good time to think through what those might be. And we have people online for Senate Bill 20 that I will describe once we have the bill presented to us. And so, Senator Meyer, Senate Bill 20 is a CS. You might explain why it's a CS and introduce the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may, before I get started here, I'd like to offer the seat to Christine Marsigan, my staff.
Ms. Marsigan, please come on up to the desk and introduce yourself so that that way if the senator needs a lifeline, he goes right to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Christine Marsigan, staff to Senator Kevin Meyer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Meyer, and I represent Senate District M, which is the southeast part of Anchorage. We do appreciate you, the Senate Committee, and you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing Senate Bill 20. This bill is a pretty simple bill. It would simply classify a synthetic opioid called U47700 as a Schedule 1A controlled substance, and also add tramadol as a Schedule 4A controlled substance. The U47700, or sometimes referred to pink or U4, is a very dangerous drug. It's 8 times more powerful than heroin. And this drug started as a research drug in the 1970s, and it was patented but never approved for human testing or consumption.
Just briefly, I just noticed that Senator Meyer's joined us. Thank you, Senator Kelly, Mr. Meyer, Senator Meyer. Thank you, and welcome, Senator Kelly.
Okay,
We just took up Senate CS for Senate Bill 20, and Senator Meyer is introducing it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, as I said, this drug initially started as a research drug in the 70s, and it was never patented. Oh, I'm sorry, it was patented, but never approved for human consumption. Now that there is such a strong demand for drugs like this, especially opioids, labs in China have been producing and selling it online at large numbers. The drug is very deadly. The National Drug Enforcement Agency reports that 45 fatalities were reported or linked to this drug in 2015. 3 of those were right here in Alaska, Mr. Chairman. The federal government has issued a temporary placement of this drug into Schedule 1 due to its imminent hazard to the public safety. Now, when this bill was heard in the HES committee last week, Senator Giesel, who serves on the opioid task force, recommended and amended the bill, adding tramadol, which is also a opioid drug. However, it's a little bit different, and it's classified differently as well. It was created by a German company in 1962. Tramadol was tested for over 15 years and was approved for market in 1977. It became available in the United States in 1995 and was widely prescribed for pain relief. Hopefully you didn't have that for your arm, Mr. Chairman. It was thought that because of its low dosage, approximately one-tenth of the strength of morphine, that this prescription drug would not need to be controlled, would be listed as a controlled substance. However, as prescriptions have been abused and diverted, there are more and more reports of tramadol dependency and abuse, withdrawal, and stealing of the medication. The DEA has classified this as a Schedule 4 controlled substance.
DEA, you might give us the acronym for those listening in.
I'm sorry, Drug Enforcement Agency.
Okay.
We are all painfully aware, especially this committee, and all the testimony and discussion we've had about the opioid crisis happening in our state, and our, in fact, the governor declared a state of emergency concerning the opioid crisis just last week. So we need to stop synthetic drugs being brought in from overseas and limit certain habit-forming prescription and medication. I urge this committee to pass this bill and classify this pink or U4 as a Schedule 1A and Tramadol as a Schedule 4A substance so that the law enforcement can go after those who will sell these drugs. Of course, also the users and those who purchase and possess and manufacture and transport these drugs. Thank you for your consideration, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. As was earlier mentioned, my staff, Christine Marsegan, is here to answer any questions that the committee may have. And also, there's a lot of experts, as you mentioned.
In fact, why don't I just introduce them right now, okay. Senator? We have Captain Dan Loudon from the Alaska State Troopers here available for questions. We have Oren Dine with the Alaska Department of Public Safety with a crime lab who probably can enlighten us. We have Jay Butler, who's with the Division of Public Health and Social Services. And then Captain Mike Duxbury, who is an Anchorage State Trooper, probably one of the experts, as I understand it, in this particular area that members of the committee can ask questions of. Right now, we can go to Christine for any backup information or maybe some description of the bill. Christine, introduce yourself again and give us your testimony as the staff aide to Senator Meyer.
For the record, my name is Christine Mercy, and staff to Senator Kevin Meyer. The senator pretty much outlined the bill in terms of bringing two drugs onto the controlled substances list, both pink, what's referred to as pink, and also tramadol. Also, with your indulgence, Mr. Chair, we also have Kate Burkhardt from Alaska Mental Health here, as well as Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law, if you have any questions.
Thank you. I do have a couple of questions, but first, committee, Senator Wilkowski. Oh,
I was just, so this would still be able to be prescribed by physicians?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes, tramadol would be.
Okay. And then, Chair,
Senator Wilkowski.
So what would the penalty then be for someone who was possessing this unlawfully? Would that be a Class C felony?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes, that's correct.
And then just wondering how that compares to some of the other drugs that we have taken action on in Senate Bill 91. Do you know that, like some of the other opioids?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, the pink bill would be classified similarly as some of the harder drugs that we've talked about in terms of opioids, but tramadol, of course, would have a lower classification.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I'd just be curious because I know there was a ratcheting down on a lot of the drugs, and it seems like this is going the opposite direction, and maybe that's warranted, but I'm just curious where it would rank it with some of the other drugs from SB 91. So maybe if we can just get that another time.
Well, and we have those online who will probably ask be able to answer some of those questions. At this point, because of the dosage involved, what would be under this penalty under Section C of 1171-140C, the dosage is not so much noted as the actual drug itself, so they would fall into the dosage requirements that we outlined in a previous law.
To the chair, that is my understanding, sir, but I do believe we have Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law that could also more clearly answer that question.
Probably we should do that, but before we bring her up, other states have had to respond to this, the pink drug for sure. Is that true on both drugs that are now involved in this bill? Can you tell us what the scope is on that?
Yes, through the chair. In regards to pink, pink is a much more lethal drug. And so you had several states that were already putting it on emergency schedules before the Drug Enforcement Agency put it on a schedule. And so now that it's on the DEA list, Drug Enforcement Agency, that will stay on for about 18 months until they decide whether it needs to be extended or if they need to actually pass the law that makes it a controlled substance. In regards to Tramadol, Tramadol has been on the Drug Enforcement Agency's list since 2014, I believe, and that comes out of the Opioid Task Force recommendations. It was originally thought because it was such a low dosage that it would not be something that would be an issue or a problem. In fact, when Tramadol was first introduced in the United States, you know, maybe out of 100,000 people, you maybe had one or two people that had problems with Tramadol. But what they're finding now, as recently as 2010, according to some pharmacy reports, is that now you're having some poison center controls having reports of up to 16,000 people a year coming in with problems with Tramadol. And so even though it is a prescription drug, it is a drug to be watched, and we did have testimony, I believe, from one of our experts that are online today that had said that, yes, they've intercepted Tramadol that have been diverted to people that were using it.
And maybe just for just as a lead-in, we do have two state troopers online, Dan Loudon and Mike Duxbury. If either one of you want to chime in on that point, now would be the time to do it and to give any testimony I think that would be helpful to us.
Chair, this is Captain Mike Duxbury. I am the captain and the supervisor for the Alaska Statewide Drug Enforcement Agency.
Thank you.
Unit. We are seeing a significant amount of Tramadol being in conjunction with other drugs being shipped to Western Alaska, being one of those drugs being abused. And it is one of the concerns from my supervisors throughout the state that although DEA has classified this drug, sir, to on a schedule, it is at a level for the federal government that we can't necessarily get a handle on and make every case a federal case, but we did need some ability to stem the tide of this abuse and its diversion to Western Alaska and other locations throughout the state, and that is the reason for the cooperative and collaborative effort here to DHSS and the Senator's office to make this a drug that we could get a handle on.
Thank you. There is a question from Senator Wilkowski, Captain. Can you take that?
Thank you. Just what is the penalty now for someone who illegally possesses Tramadol? And I thought it under this law it would go to a Class C felony, but it looks to me like maybe it just goes to a Class A misdemeanor. Is that correct?
I believe, through the chair, sir, I believe you are correct. The present condition is that if you do not have a prescription for it, it falls into a diverted situation, and we're not doing too much in terms of enforcement of it. The reason to put it on the schedule was so that we could do some enforcement and take some action and to probably stem the tide of it being diverted to different areas. Please excuse me, I have a terrible cold.
We're kind of glad that you're distanced from us then, because we don't want it. Probably one of the questions that we'll probably we'll have to think about as we go along this, it's the fact of it, and then there's the use and volume of it. So if an individual is taking it, that's one charge. But then if what is the normal size of, say, personal use over against people selling it in volume? How would you determine that?
Sir, in terms of what we are seeing in terms of the diversion is it's often not in a labeled prescription bottle. It is in some bulk format, in baggies. and that it happens to be a significant amount of pills. I cannot speak to the therapeutic use and volume for that, and that's I know that we have other experts online right now that could help us with that.
Yeah, because we've heard anecdotally that, for example, there are some pills that that had opioid parts to them that people would crush up and sell as powder, or one pill could be lethal, and we've heard the lethality of the schedule, the pink that is brought up. So maybe Dan Loudon can enlighten us a little bit on that. Can you chime in on that, Captain?
Senator Coghill, I wish I could, but Mr. Duxbury is our expert, and I've been deferring to him.
Okay, thank you. All right, well, what we're looking for is the for example, we've upped trafficking as far as volume in some areas to then charge them in the felony area. And is that something that's easier or harder to discern with these?
Well, the application of the law, sir, would be in conjunction with where it's been listed. I believe that you will find that a certain amount would be at a level and then the next amount would be, and I don't have that listing right in front of me, but would up the level of responsibility and penalty for the case depending on the amount that's being transported and smuggled.
That's probably something we'll get the department a lot to help us with, and I see where my staff has at least opened the statute book to that place. So, Senator Wilkowski?
Oh, I don't know who this may be for, but I'm just looking through the fiscal notes, and it's got zero, looks to me like zero fiscal notes from Department of Public Safety and zero from Corrections, and is the assumption that we will not arrest anyone because of this? Because usually if there's an indeterminate, Mr. Chairman, I believe, but here it's a zero.
Maybe Christine can enlighten us on that.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, Christine Mercy, and staff to Senator Kevin Meyer. The individual departments, of course, can answer to what they feel the fiscal note reflects. However, I just wanted to get back to, because I know you guys were talking about in terms of amount, that it would be for if there's distribution, like a class 1A is like less than a gram, is this, or more than a gram is a C felony. More than 25 tablets is also a C felony.
Okay.
And then it's, I think you were talking about possession earlier, which if it's 1A, any amount for possession, a small, you know, that you're not distributing, it's a class A misdemeanor, same for the 4A. Yeah,
and I think that's what we had opened up the statute to. Yeah. Senator Wilkowski.
Just, I don't know if anyone's available on the fiscal note, but one other question on the fiscal note is if someone is arrested under the federal law, I assume our state troopers could do that and our police could do that, and there obviously be a cost there. But if they were imprisoned under federal law, I guess I'd also assume the federal government picks up those costs as opposed to the state. Is that your understanding as well?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I would assume that as well, but we do have somebody from the Department of Law that would be able to answer that question.
So we should probably get the Department of Law. That's two questions that we've hit on that Department of Law can at least give us some enlightenment on. Why don't we have the Department of Law come up here, and then Captain Duxbury, if you have something you want to add on after the public Department of Law, then maybe your work with the federal government can enlighten us on the enforcement side. But right now we have the Department of Law. Put yourself on the record, and we can ask the question.
Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law.
Thank you, Casey. You want to restate that question?
I'm just trying to, well, there's zero fiscal notes, which I guess your department, I guess your department could be impacted by that. And I don't know if I saw one from law, I saw one from Public Safety and Corrections, though. I'm just curious how we got zero instead of indeterminate, and that's number one. And number two is, If we leave it on the federal, as a federal violation, would the federal government pay the cost for the imprisonment as opposed to the state if we make it a state violation?
through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, you are correct. If the federal government decides to prosecute either one of these substances, they would be responsible for the cost of prosecution as well as the cost of incarceration. And generally, they are housed in Alaska during their trial period, but they would then be moved to a federal penitentiary. The issue with putting them on an Alaska schedule is that it avails the state then to dedicate resources towards enforcing and controlling these substances. The federal government is spread pretty thin. We can't always rely on them to enforce maybe perhaps the way we would want things to be enforced. So,
Casey, Mr. Schroeder, one of the questions then that comes immediate to mind is our penalty commensurate with the federal penalty, or are we able to closely mirror what they're doing?
Chair Coghill, I believe the federal penalties have a broader range and are a little bit stiffer than the state penalty, but the state would have as closer to the ground and has better enforcement capabilities than the feds generally would. They generally focus on much larger cases.
And the fiscal note question, maybe you can give a little more insight into, at least from your department.
There is a zero fiscal note from the Department of Law. And it's zero because we don't anticipate asking for another position solely to prosecute these offenses. We don't expect there to be such a rash that we would need another attorney, which is why it's zero. We think it's something that we can already handle within our existing caseloads.
And my guess is that would be pretty much the case across the fiscal notes that I've seen. But we can get more specific on that if you want, Senator.
Senator. Maybe somebody can walk me through how this would work if someone was caught with tramadol right now. I assume APD or Fairbanks or Juneau Police could arrest them, or a trooper could arrest them, turn them over to the federal authorities under existing law right now, and then it would be for the federal government to prosecute, use federal judicial resources, use federal correction facilities. Is that how it would work right now?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, the state absolutely could not prosecute that. As far as arrest, I would defer to DPS and how much they are able to actually enforce federal law.
And maybe we can go back to our state troopers at this point and ask about the relationship with the federal government, and whoever, whether it's Captain Loudon or Captain Duxbury, maybe you could speak to both working with and taking on the responsibility of state and federal law.
This is Captain Duxbury.
Yes.
I can tell you that through state law, we have a solid relationship with the DEA, with the Department of Drug Enforcement, and through that, we also have folks that are assigned as what we would call task force officers. In that situation, their thresholds for the amount of impact and amount of drug that we would need in order to make a federal case would be so significant that, for instance, a small amount of drugs, an ounce of something like methamphetamine in one of our villages, is a huge impact that village because of the surface area that it gets to suck money out of the village, that the impact it has on the lives and the communities, and the detriment that it has. That is in a level of methamphetamine product that the federal government wishes to take on, and so we, on a regular basis, use state statute to enforce laws that impact the people and help to deter folks from making money off of other people's misery and weakness. The reason why we are asking to schedule the tramadol on the state schedule is for those reasons where we can have an impact. What we will see often right now and expect to see a continuance of is tramadol is one of those cheaper opioid type, and I'm not saying it is an opioid, but it produces some opioid type effects that people use to abuse it, and that we see that in conjunction with other drugs being shipped to the villages and used in our smaller areas, and we will see that often seized in conjunction conjunction with methamphetamine and other opioids. So it will not be something that you would say, like, for instance, in the past you would see cocaine being shipped into a place and that was the drug being shipped. We have a much, a big problem in Alaska, Chair, because we're a polydrug use area and almost no drugs are produced here except for the non-legalized marijuana.
Thank you. That's another element that I hadn't really thought about, and that is how many of these things will be added to each other, and then enforcement then becomes probably a tool that if you can at least identify one more clearer than the other, that gives you reasons to both hold them accountable, apprehend them, right?
Chair, I agree with that statement wholeheartedly. It gives us just another tool in our ability to have an impact on those folks that have decided to make money off of other people's misery.
So the other question is on this pink or this the newer drug, the U47700, and it has words in there. Is that something that you already alert to, and is that something you can identify fairly readily, Captain Duxbury?
I can tell you that there are two methods that we have identified as being introduced into the state of Alaska. One of them is definitely on the internet. You can type the words in pink or U47700 and ask for a purchase and find it readily available. But I also know that there are a number of smoke shops that have made it available throughout the state. And it is something that we've had three deaths in the state of Alaska with the folks from DHSS who are much in collaboration and in efforts to take care of these things can tell you is a significant amount. Anytime we lose an individual to this drug abuse problem, we lose a jewel that could have come out the other side to help others and to provide us with those abilities to get the information out there about how to stay away. And I see our job in the Alaska State Troopers and our collaborative efforts on these things as how do we keep the children of our state from having to make tough choices about the things that they would like to experiment with? How about keeping them in those positive choices of the experiments that build on their lives and don't take away from their resumes? This drug, pink, is one of those substitutes at a cheaper price that takes away our ability to bring our youth into a productive society and have them help us. So this is a very, very important situation because it's marketed in places that are vulnerable to youth, the internet, and in under the table in smoke shops, which are, you know, bright colors and all kinds of things that are marketed to youth. So I see our jobs as interdiction, and that interdiction and education is how do we keep the kids from having to make tough choices.
Well said, and we join you in that effort. It's interesting to me that this is number 82 of the issues, and it just looks like society dishes them up almost as fast as we can identify them. But I think it's important that we identify them because we probably, on some of this list, we'll see them regularly, but they have taken so many different shapes and methods that you have to be very specific. Otherwise, what I take it, Captain Duxbury, is it's awful hard to enforce if it's not explicitly named.
In the case of the research that I've done on pink itself, sir, again, it's marketed in a way that is just drawing youngsters in. Second of all, it's marketed in a way that if you don't have a lot of money, then it's very vulnerable to folks that don't have a standard course of having money, making money and having it at their hands. The third thing that I would say is, given what all of us are dealing with in the state of Alaska in terms of budget, is the only way that we are going to be able to have a better chance at getting a hold of these things is collaborative between the different agencies. Secondarily to that is folks being able to understand that we have to reduce how much consumption there is and get back to giving education to youngsters. And being able to look at these things in the light that you guys are, thank God, taking a look at it today and saying, asking the tough questions, how do we do the best we can with it? the DEA chemist that I spoke with at length and the other expert of Las Vegas told me that, yes, there's a slight possibility that you can change this. It doesn't have a great effect on it. They've only seen one change in it, so it doesn't have as much of a possibility like Spice did for us to chase our tails on. But again, you are accurate in saying that there are a number of people out there in the world that don't mind making their profit, or whatever that is, off of other people's misery, and we're chasing our tails with the budget cuts that we have.
Yes, and we don't want to make it any tougher on you. In fact, we want to make it a safer place. And so for this, I thank the sponsor and for you that have to deal with it. And on the public education side, I know that Mr. Butler from the Department of Health and Social Services has been working overtime trying to make sure that people understand these. Mr. Butler, at this point, is there anything that you'd like to add as far as the communication side of this, so that if we pass this into law, that it just doesn't become another page in our law books?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer in the Department of Health and Social Services. It's hard to add anything to what Captain Duxbury has said. I think he's really outlined the situation very nicely. I will add that part of the outreach has been to the clinical community to make sure that people are aware that what may look like a prescription opioid overdose or a heroin overdose may be something else altogether. And that's particularly important when the drug tests that are used in clinical situations are used because they may not detect some of these newer agents. As the earlier testimony pointed out, we know of three deaths in Alaska due to U4. And again, the DEA website describes only a few dozen nationally. I don't personally think that it's because it's that much more prevalent here. I think we've been a little more aggressive at our toxicologic testing through the state medical examiner's office because of concern and some of the shared information that we've been able to receive from public safety to know that this might be a concern. The other thing I'll add is that sometimes users are not aware of what they're using, and that might make sense since we're really talking about illicit drugs. But another part of the messaging is that what looks like a prescription opioid may actually be counterfeit, and there have been instances in the lower 48 where what looks like a Norco pill is actually made up of fentanyl as well as U4, and of course those are both much more powerful opioids than what would normally be in a prescription Norco tablet. So we've been trying to get the word out on that, and so we look forward to continuing to work with our colleagues in public safety and as well as Department of Law to help Alaskans know the risk and that there is hope in terms of a possibility of living in recovery.
Thank you, Mr. Butler, and I appreciate that. I do have a question for Oren Dime with the crime lab. Are both of these, and especially this new U4, do we have ways that police can tell very rapidly from the crime lab without having to go through a timely process that it is, in fact, this drug so that they can be pretty definitive? Or is that something that we have to go through the timely process of testing in order to do a proper charging?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Oren Dim. I'm the forensic laboratory manager. In terms of identification, we have no field method right now. We are actually validating, working on a field instrument for the officers to see if they are capable of detecting this in the field. Part of the challenge is the extremely low dosage sometimes that these come in, make it very difficult to detect. But in terms of laboratory analysis, we are turning controlled substance cases around in about 7 days. So that is pretty rapid time for definitive analysis, and we do have the capability to detect both drugs, no problem.
Thank you, and thank you for correcting me on saying your last name, Mr. Dim. So I apologize for that. I will assign new names almost at any turn I can. So this goes back to Captain Duxbury then. Is it enough to have this on the books to have you be able to confiscate and to charge during that time? I'm just wondering about the effectiveness and how you're able to discern those things. Is it something that you can tell fairly rapidly by its color, size, or method of delivery?
Mr. Chairman, no. We have to do a full analysis on it. We run it through our gas chromatograph mass spectrometer. The last instance of U4 we had here, well, the only instance of U4 was actually a counterfeit tablet. The markings on the tablet indicated it was an oxycodone-type tablet. Analysis indicated it was U4. So there was no way for an officer, even if they had the ability to look up the markings, to know that it contained U4.
So, and the reason I brought that up is, number one, for knowledge of your tools, but secondly, for those watching, it's if they are willing to destroy your life, they're also willing to take your money by foolery. So,
Chair, this is Mike Duxbury, Alaska State Troopers. Again, you've made a very accurate statement. The other thing that we have concerns on, and as was touched on by Dr. Butler from DHSS, is that the mixture of more powerful opioids with counterfeit drugs and drugs made to look like things that they're willing to, this is not a, the people that are willing to make this money are not a perfect relationship with their customers. They don't necessarily care, they just want their money, and they'll cut it with cheaper stuff which can be more potent, such as fentanyl and carfentanyl. And frankly, right now, 2.5 grams of carfentanyl or heroin fentanyl or carfentanyl can kill a lot of people because of its overdose capabilities, and it has the ability to be absorbed through skin and breathing and stuff like that. In the lower 48 are finding times when troopers, as many as six in Massachusetts at one point in time, ended up in the hospital, and there have been three cases where drug dogs have sniffed this stuff and actually gone to respiratory arrest, and they lost three dogs. That is not kink per se, but it is the fact that the folks that are manufacturing this stuff don't necessarily have any controls or any standards like you would expect from other drugs, so we have to be very careful what we're doing.
Thank you very much. I think you've expressed the deadliness of what we have to deal with in a society. Further questions, committee members? I appreciate the line of questioning and the kind of the problem of describing both the quantity and penalty, because it's harder and harder to hit those targets. But Senate Bill 91 set a cadre up, and it looks like it's still within the range, but it's amazing how deadly these things can be. Just absolutely amazing. So I think giving the tools, first of all, describing it a law so that I think our state people can deal with it. So I've been at least made more aware than ever before how important it is for them to have those tools to be able to stop it. So questions, comments from the committee? I think I've reached a point where I'm willing to set it aside and then bring it back up Wednesday. Senator Meyer?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do appreciate you taking the time and bringing this bill up before the Judiciary Committee. As you know, I've done other synthetic drug bills in the past as well, the spice bath salts, and it does seem like at times we're kind of chasing our tail. But I think we are making progress. I mean, you certainly don't hear about the spice and bath salts anymore. And now pink is the new fad synthetic drug. You know, the bottom line is we can do all these bills we want. As long as there's demand out there, somebody's going to make the product. And in this case now, they believe it's being made in China and purchased online. And so I do appreciate Dr. Butler and others trying to do public education, because frankly that's the only way we're going to stop the demand. But I do think having laws in place can at least prohibit people for getting in the business of supplying these opioids to you know, to people who are addicted to it. And as you know, that's caused a lot of our problems that we have today in our communities throughout the state, whether it's the users breaking into your house to get some money to buy the drugs, or the pushers or dealers who are shooting each other because of a drug deal gone bad. We need to put a stop to it, and the best way is to try to eliminate the demand. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and I appreciate Department of Law being here, Christine being here. The issue is brought before us, very dramatic, as more deadly than I had anticipated as far as the effects of these drugs. So very sobering, and I think it's an appropriate action. So I'm going to lay this bill aside until Wednesday, which I intend to take it up. So if there's other comments, questions, amendments, Wednesday's the day, and I'd like to keep public testimony open only if somebody wants to step forward and make sure they have a comment on record. Other than that, we'll lay Senate Bill 20 aside, and thank you very much, Senator Meyer.
Thank you.
And then we'll take up Senate Bill 6, and we've been joined with us. Senator Hughes is with us, who has the next bill before us, Senate Bill 6. And she's been here with us through this other discussion as well, which I greatly appreciate. So we have Senate Bill 6, which is dealing with regulating in the Department of Agriculture industrial hemp. So why don't we have you and your staff come up, Senator, and we'll introduce this bill. And my intention today is to go through the bill in order, let the senator and her staff lay it out for us, and open up at the high-level questions. And my intention is to bring it back. I know that there is other things that they intend to bring before us in this bill, but it was brought to us because there are some penalty provisions in here that need to be clarified. But at that point, I will let the senator introduce the bill, and we'll get on with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Coghill and Senator Meyer. I'm Shelley Hughes, and I represent District F, the Palmer-Chugiak area. And I was going to start, Mr. Chair, by making a joke about how three of your members already heard the bill in another committee, and that I would do this presentation for Senator Kelly, who has stepped out. So I realized I basically have the same opening that I had in the prior committee, but I'll quickly go through it for the record.
Thank you.
And then
there are those who are listening in probably who haven't had a chance. So take your time, go through it.
Yes, thank you. And we will have to update because there are a lot of very interesting factoids about him historically, but I have the same ones I gave before. So perhaps in a closing statement, we'll bring up some new ones.
All right.
Last spring, my office was contacted by several farmers in the Mat-Su area because our former colleague Senator Ellis had a bill that would have allowed industrial hemp to be defined as an agricultural product. And there was interest in that, and one of those was Mat-Su former borough mayor Larry DeVilbiss. And so we looked at it, but it was quite late in the session and not time to get it through the process. And it was brought to my attention throughout the summer and fall when I would have meetings with constituents and town halls, so committed to bringing it back up. So we did roll it out. It looks a little bit different than what you may recall seeing last year, and that is because of some new federal statutes and regulations that have unfolded. And I will let Buddy address those particularly if there's any question about that. But there's a long history, and as I said in the prior committee, typically I have worked on things that kind of look forward and ahead and looking at innovative new technology, those kind of things, such as unmanned aircraft. In this case, I feel like we're playing catch-up because this is a product that's been around for centuries, but we halted its growth in our country back in 1937. And now we have the opportunity as a state to allow it to be an agriculture product once again. But in our early country's history, it was used as the canvas for ship sails that brought settlers to this country. It was the Declaration of Independence was written on paper made of hemp. And when they headed out west, covered wagons, hemp was used as the canvas on the covered wagons. So currently it's being used for over 25,000 products. Some of the farmers are particularly interested in it as to use for feed for livestock. And there's just countless opportunities. And so this is one more economic opportunity, I believe, that we should allow for the agricultural community to try out. There is a lot of thought that it might grow very well here. And as a judicial committee, you might be interested to know, and particularly since Senator Kelly, through the chair, did not hear what we heard in the Resources Committee. It was very reassuring to me. You know, you always learn something when you do these bills. It was very reassuring to hear, for me, to hear from the Division of Agriculture that if a farmer were to grow hemp, he or she would not plant it the same way he or she would plant if they were intending to grow marijuana. The spacing of the plants, the spacing of the rows would be very different. And so even though the plant itself, just to the naked eye, looks the same, the way it would be planted would be different. So it would be quite easy for the Department of Public Safety, any of the officers, to tell if someone were growing it for anything other than the purpose of hemp. So basically this bill would take hemp from under the criminal statutes and put it under the jurisdiction of the Division of Agriculture. And there are, as I said before, the bill's a little bit longer than when Senator Ellis had it last year, and it's because of the federal requirements for registration and other things. So with that, Mr. Chair, I have my staffer, Buddy Witt, here, who can briefly speak to each section if you like. He can explain the changes that were made in the CS to meet the federal requirements or address any other questions, or he would also know if he can't answer the question to whom they should be directed.
Sure, and at that point maybe I'll just bring up who's actually available to us to answer questions. We have Arthur Keyes with the Division of Agriculture and the Department of Natural Resources. We have Captain Dan Loudon, again, Alaska State Troopers. He's available for questions. Joan Wilson, who is the Assistant Attorney General, who is able to answer some of the legal questions if need be. Rob Carter is also the Plant Materials Center Manager at the Division of Agriculture. And then Captain Mike Duxbury, again, with the Alaska State Troopers. So they're available here. And we'll just see if there's questions. Senator Meyer, you had a right off the bat question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Hughes, for bringing this before the Judiciary Committee. I did hear it in the resources, so I think I know the answer to my question, but maybe we could just get it on the record. If somebody is planting a crop of industrial hemp, and then let's say the market collapse, and they say, well, what the heck, I'm just going to sell it as recreational hemp. Could they do that?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I'm going to let Buddy also take this, but I'm going to say my preliminary answer, and I'll let him finish up, is that because the THC is below 0.3%, there wouldn't be much recreation. In fact, the person would probably be hacking and coughing if they were trying to use it that way. And the cutoff for any kind of hallucinogenic effects is 1%. So 0.3 is less than a third of that is what is how hemp is defined. So there's not going to be much recreation in that. So if I could, through the chair,
sure,
allow
Buddy, you can just pick up from there, and then in answering that question, then you can go ahead and take us through the bill in its order.
this.
Thank you, Chair Coghill. For the record, my name is Buddy Witt, staff to Senator Shelley Hughes. The research that we've been given that we have done shows that the USDA does recognize industrial hemp as cannabis with no more than 1% THC, because it is at that point, somewhere between 1% and 3%, depends on the strain, that there is a possibility of it containing enough THC to cause what you might call the unwanted side effects that you would find in marijuana. And the federal law actually defines it as hemp as 0.3% or lower, specifically to stay as far away from that definition of what causes those side effects as possible. Does that answer your question, sir?
Mr. Chairman, I think that does, buddy. So I think you answered it that yes, they could sell it as recreational hemp, but it wouldn't give you the buzz or the high that of course a regular recreational hemp would. So why would you waste your time and I guess smoking it?
I think I would ask Senator Meyer through the chair. I would also add a couple other points that go along with that, and that is under this bill, should it pass, a person would be required to register whether the market had dropped out or not. They would be required to register in order to grow the hemp. So if they were not registered and to grow the hemp and were growing it anyway, they would be in violation, and there would be penalties assigned to that that fall under Title III that I can speak to more specifically. If they grew if they had a parcel of land and they grew this plant and it was above the 0.3% THC level, then by law is classified as marijuana, and they're therefore be guilty of having an illegal marijuana grow. So there are several different aspects of statute both in place already and that this bill provides that would go to answer your question.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. And Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up.
Senator Meyer.
So I think Senator Hughes had mentioned that there's some thought that this will grow fairly easily or quite well here in Alaska. And I was wondering what that is based on. Is it based on the fact that it's a lot like barley or other crops that do quite well here in Alaska, or have we actually done some testing?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, I will tell you what I know, sir, and then I would like to hand that off to Rob Carter, who's the agronomist with the Plant Materials Center, to expound upon that. And a constituent of Senator Hughes, Mr. Ken Ray, actually sent our office a clipping from 1918, I believe, and it is in your packet, that shows in Palmer, Alaska, gives a report of hemp growing in Palmer, Alaska, how well it grew, when it was planted, when it was harvested, and in the span of just a few months, it grew over 4 feet. So that is what I can speak to on the historical side. But I will hand it over to Mr. Rob Carter, the agronomist with the state, who can expound upon that.
Sure. And Mr. Carter, thanks for joining us. I see that you're available for questions. Did you hear that particular dialogue, and do you have any input?
Chair, yes, sir, I did. This is, for the record, this is Rob Carter, the Division of Ag and Plant Materials Center Manager. My apologies if my son chimes in. Today is a holiday, so I am I'm in the father role here.
Good for you.
Through the chair, Senator, yes, there has been actually what's come to my knowledge here. It was in 1916 that industrial hemp was initially trialed in Alaska. And as we've all known and see every day, that our growing conditions have changed dramatically. They were successful in growing that, and that trial was actually, from the knowledge I have in the paper and literature I've seen, was actually north of the range with even a shorter growing season than the traditional Matsus who sit in the valley. I would say that due to Alaska's long period and 100-plus growing days, hemp is actually very likely to produce very well up here on a biomass note. The cannabis genus itself has some proto-period issues with seed production,
But the research and the knowledge is, of that is just unknown. But we, from an agronomic standpoint, we do believe that there's a lot of potential, especially for the use of a forage crop to feed the livestock industry.
Thank you, and for doing double duty today.
I didn't get that last one.
I think Senator Kelly just wanted you to repeat that last couple of sentences you put in there.
The last sentence
would be fine. To the Chair, Senator Kelly, yes, we do believe with the long day lengths that we do have, the changing growing conditions that we've seen since 1916, that industrial hemp has a significant chance of being an excellent producer here in the state of Alaska.
Senator Meyer also had a question.
Okay, yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I'm just trying to, I'm kind of reflecting back here in my farm days in Nebraska, where, you know, when you harvest a crop, it, you know, you get a combine out there, and then you separate the seed from the stalk, and then take the seed to the elevator. So is that how this would work as well? You would just harvest it like a, I guess, like barley or like wheat, and or does it take special equipment and machines?
Through the Chair, Senator, there's actually a multitude of ways to harvest this, and it depends on the scale that the producer that was growing would use. It is very mechanized in large-scale production in Canada, where they use traditional combines to harvest the grain of the crop. And then the forage is then followed and harvest behind that. If an individual is just trying to grow for the fiber industry, they go through a very similar procedure. They may cut it earlier if it's not producing seed. That stuff then goes through a redding process, just a natural digestion process to remove some of the plant products to make the fiber more available. And that can be done as simple with a sickle mower.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carter. One more question coming up from Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Actually, maybe for the bill sponsor.
Okay, for the sponsor.
If we're done.
Mr. Carter, thank you, and we're going to relieve you, let you go back on your own mute, and thank you for stepping up
thank
today.
Thank you, sir.
So a couple questions. On page 1, line 12, it says, an individual who produces industrial hemp shall apply to the department for registration. Is there a contemplation that that application can be denied?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, that is correct. The Division of Agriculture, in order to, let me back up, and I will divert to Division of Agriculture Director Arthur Keyes shortly, if I may, Chair. The idea being, in order for to start this pilot program, the division would have the ability to choose, and I believe in their fiscal note they said up to 15 growers initially to start in this pilot program. That was the number that they came up with, and he can speak more about how they came up with that number, but my belief after speaking to them was they believed that that was the number that would be manageable in initially starting the program and then deciding in future years whether to expand or retract upon that.
And we can have him go ahead and answer that question, but part of my method was to let him lay the bill out in order today, but we can go ahead and get Mr. Keyes to chime in on that particular thing, because we are going to have to deal with this in both accountability and all the what-ifs. If we put a rule in, what happens if somebody doesn't obey the rule? And that's what we're going to do, probably not this go-around, but the next go-around. And so I think all the accountability measures we need to take in order. But first, I'd like to have them lay it out. And since most of us have heard this, I think you can kind of zip through the big concepts because we're going to be mostly interested in the penalty provisions or the accountability measures.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chair Coghill.
By the way, do you want Mr. Keyes to chime in on that right off the bat, or do you want to? Okay, I will excuse you, Arthur Keyes, for a moment while we go through and look at the bill in big pieces thing. Thank you. So, buddy, you're up.
Thank you, sir. If
if the chair will allow me, I will just go through the bill using the sectional analysis. Section 1, AS0305078 is industrial hemp would be classified as an agricultural crop in the state of Alaska. An individual who is registered with the state of Alaska may produce industrial hemp. Those wishing to produce industrial hemp must register with the Division of Agriculture with information that must include but is not limited to name, address, and global positioning coordinates of the area to be used for that production. I will add that that is specifically addressed that is specifically put in order to address the Farm Act of 2014. Those are provisions that the federal government has mandated. Section E, D, registration is valid for 1 year and registrants may renew on an annual basis. In E, the Division of Agriculture may assign application registration or renewal fees. The Division of Agriculture shall assign application registration or renewal fees necessary to regulate the industrial hemp industry and shall review those fees structures annually to ensure those fees collected cover regulatory costs. In F, Division of Agriculture may issue a stop sale order or issue a violation notice if someone is producing industrial hemp without a current registration. G, a person registered with the Division of Agriculture may use any propagation method needed to produce their industrial hemp. And H, the Division of Agriculture, a registered producer, or any institution of higher education may import and or sell industrial hemp seeds. I, a person with a registration may retain hemp seeds for the purpose of growing hemp in the future. J, a person registered with the Division of Agriculture to produce industrial hemp may retain and recondition hemp that tests between 0.3% and 1% THC on a dry weight basis, but industrial hemp intended for consumption in any form cannot exceed a 0.3 THC level. K, the Division of Agriculture may create regulations for approved shipping documentation for transporting industrial hemp. L, registered producers of industrial hemp must retain record of sale for at least 3 years, including the name and address of the person who received the industrial hemp and the amount that was sold. M, records in section, M, records in section L are to be made available to the department during normal business hours, and the department must give 3 days' notice prior to the inspection of those records. Section 2, and Alaska Statute 03.05079, in keeping with federal law, this section adds language regarding a pilot program for industrial hemp that the Division of Agriculture, an institute of higher education, or a registered grower may participate in the pilot program, and that the Division of Agriculture may adopt regulations for this section. In Section 3, Alaska Statute 0305100, the definition of industrial hemp, which meets the definition in federal statute, is the plant Cannabis sativa L containing less than 0.3% delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, THC. In Section 4, Alaska Statute 11.71.900 is amended to remove industrial hemp as defined in 0305100 from the list of controlled substances. Section 5, Alaska Statute 17.20.020, food containing industrial hemp as defined is not considered adulterated. And Section 6, 17.38.900, is amended to further remove industrial hemp as defined from marijuana definitions.
As passed by the people of Alaska, which we're in the right time frame on that, I think, for amending that.
Yes, sir. I believe so.
Thank you. So my thinking on this is there's a lot of questions. How are you going to do that, and what happens if you don't do what's required of you?
Yes, sir.
And so as we go through the issue here, for example, I think Senator Wilkowski started down the questioning. What's the cost of registering, and what's the cost if you don't register and you're growing, those types of things. So we're going to go down those If, for example, the department says there's a stop sale, what do we do? So I guess the question that I'm going to ask, and they're in two sections, what should be criminal activity and what should be a fee-based fine, for incentives? And I don't know that you've thought that through so much, but that's something that we're going to be tasked to think through here. And there are probably times where a fee sanction is probably more effective than a criminal sanction. There are some times where a criminal sanction is going to be more valuable than a sanction that is fee-based. So, Buddy, you're up.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Thank you, Chair Coghill. Yes, sir. And I would like to point to Alaska Statute 03.05.090, already in statute, where it talks about penalties for violations under the Division of Agriculture. There are several, two in particular penalties that are mentioned. One, and I would like to read straight from the statute, sure, if I may.
And just give me the citation again.
Yes, sir. Alaska Statute 03.05.090.
Okay.
In A, a person who violates a provision of this chapter or a regulation, order, or quarantine made under authority of this chapter, or violates a provision of a permit issued under this chapter, or sells seeds failing to meet the labeling requirements, standards, and tests provided for by regulation of the Commissioner of Natural Resources or the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor for each offense. In Part B, a person who violates an order issued, a regulation adopted, a permit issued, a quarantine imposed, or an embargo ordered under Alaska Statute 03.05.011, or a person who directs or orders a person to commit the violation is subject to a civil fine of not more than $500 for each violation.
Okay.
Those are the two specific parts of that I wanted to mention in reference to the Division of Agriculture's ability to take further action upon someone who is growing without being registered. The second part, sir, I would say, and if I may, I would add, the last Friday, several members of the Department of Law, as well as Mr. Keyes and Mr. Rob Carter, we all sat on a conference call in which some additional worries were brought to our attention about the bill. Mm-hmm. So we anticipate talking to the chair and to your staff about making some of those changes. One was adding that the Division of Agriculture has regulatory authority and putting that at the front of the bill in order to set up that the Division of Agriculture will be handling all the regulatory needs in order to make this pilot program happen. Number two, if the committee would turn to page 2 of the bill in section, pardon me, page 2, lines 18 through 21. There was concern in this section allows for a farmer whose crop has creeped, who has gone above 0.3 THC to try to rehabilitate his crop or recondition it without having to destroy the entire crop. The concern brought to our attention was that according to the law, if a farmer has 20 acres of industrial hemp that has creeped above 0.3% THC, then by definition they are growing marijuana, they have an illegal marijuana grow, and they are guilty of a pretty serious crime. So at one point the senator wants to protect the farmer who has the best intentions in mind from being guilty of a very serious crime, but also wants to protect the farmer from having to destroy an entire crop that they might have put a lot of time and personal monies into. So we would like to work again with you and your staff in trying to refine that language.
So, and on this language, what we need to know is, can that be proactively mitigated in the growing process to make sure that percentage is actually managed, or do you have to blend different stocks to get it? And I think that's, we don't need the answer to that now, but as we go forward.
Sounds like it.
So that was really going to be one of my own questions is how do they know when they're planting it what that percentage is going to be? Is it based on a genetic strain or is it based on something else? So is that based on soil quality, for example?
Chair Coghill, thank you for the question, sir. I think that's a question best answered by Mr. Rob Carter.
Mr. Carter, I hate to keep bothering you, but we have another question. And that is the THC level, is that managed by genetics or is that based on soil or water quality?
Senator, there's definitely a two-folded answer there. By strain, hemp has been selected over the years and through the process, especially since 2014, Farm Bill legalized state's ability to start pilot programs to trial this. The strains have been selected to maintain limited to no THC below that 0.3%. But due to the lack of research in the last 70 years, we are not too solid on saying that environmental conditions such as soil, nitrogen applications, photo period, moisture content, or stress may not push those crops above that 0.3%. But by strain, they have been developed and selected to stay below that limit. And to touch base on a statement that was made, when reconditioning a crop like any other crop for germination or purity, if there was a crop that was above that and they had another crop that was significantly below that, those two then in turn could be blended or quote-unquote reconditioned to make sure that the entire lot was below that 0.3%.
Okay, thank you. Since you're on, the question with marijuana and this probably gets over they look alike. So do the leaves have the same texture? And because I had talked to Mike Duxbury earlier, the idea of selling things that are not necessarily what they claim to be, could these leaves be dried and sold and maybe even laced with something else? You just wonder if we're creating another enterprise. And so do they look the same? Do they dry the same?
Phenotypically, sir, excuse me, Senator, phenotypically, yes, the plant leaves will be similar to what is grown in the recreational cannabis industry. I think to say that if that plant product was dried down, crushed ground, you would have a difficult timing determining that between rosemary or sage. So I think that saying that this could open up another industry, there's plenty of other legal products that could be purchased on the open market at Costco that could then in turn be adulterated with some other product. Our hope and our intent from the division is to support an agricultural industry, and I think that most of the farmers they're going to be going in this on this larger scale or have a different mindset of where this product's going to go.
Thank you, and we have to continually be suspicious, that's all.
I agree with you 100%.
So thank you very much for chiming in on that.
Yes,
that helps. Other questions, Senator Wilkowski?
Thank you. Is this, I know in the initiative that was passed there was a tax provision for marijuana. Is this, does that cover hemp at all, or would there be a tax on hemp other than a corporate income tax possibly?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, by removing them from the marijuana statutes, the tax does not apply. In fact, that was one of the things the farmers, when they initially brought this to me, they said that it just for them to go through, be under the jurisdiction of the Marijuana Control Board and pay the taxes, it would not be worth it. So this removes it from that. As far as corporate taxes, that I am not sure. I suppose if a farmer has a business that's incorporated and is paying corporate taxes, that this would fall under that.
And I think just at this point it would depend upon how he organizes a business, under what corporation law. Senator Wilkowski?
In a different section, Mr. Chairman, page 2, lines 5 through 9. We talked about this a little bit in the Resources Committee. It says the department shall establish fee levels for application, registration, and renewal of registration. so that the total amount of fees collected under this section approximately equals the regulatory costs for regulating the industrial hemp industry. I'm just wondering, upon reflection, why this is in here at all, considering that the fiscal note from Department of Natural Resources is zero through 2023, and all the other fiscal notes are zero. So maybe we should just take that section out.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the idea of including this language is so that the Division of Agriculture, should this crop explode in popularity for farmers throughout the state, and they are running into an issue where the cost of running the program, cost of keeping on top of the number of growers, should they exceed 15, they would have something that they can fall back onto should they need to find revenue to keep the program going without going into unrestricted general funds. That was the idea of the provision.
Ma'am? Senator Wilkowski?
I'm just looking at, again, at the fiscal note. It's not an indeterminate. It's a zero for going out through 6 years. And it says they're expecting 25 farms, and then they're expecting a 10% growth each year after the first year. So they are anticipating a pretty significant number of farms, much higher than the 15 that was cited. So I don't know if that's a sloppy fiscal note or a disingenuous fiscal note, but I think fiscal notes should reflect we have a $3 billion deficit. This is the second bill hearing in a row where now we've got zero fiscal notes on bills that are clearly going to cost money. And so I guess that's just a statement, Mr. Chairman. But if it's going to cost money, we should know about it. I think so. And I guess secondly, and my concern, and I expressed this concern in the Resources Committee, was boy, if you only have 15 farms and the state decides they need to hire one person at a range 22 or 24, it's going to cost $100,000. All of a sudden, you go from a $25 fee or a zero fee to a $10,000 a farm fee or $8,000 a farm fee. So I think the executive branch could by executive fiat, if they chose, kill this entire industry by simply hiring one or two people and saying you've got to adjust the fees and collect $100,000, $200,000, which would be completely burdensome and put this entire industry out of business.
Senator Hughes.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I really appreciate your concern. And I actually shared some of those similar concerns. Getting a bill through is tough, and I think the Division of Ag, they really want to welcome this industry and work, and they wanted to keep, with a pilot project of 15, they felt like they could have a zero fiscal note. Now, you did indicate that they do expect that would grow, and so their request was to have the ability to set up a fee structure so they wouldn't have to come back to the legislature. I, at one point, was with you on that as far as maybe should we just strike that. And I would entertain that if the committee thought that was a good idea. I do feel like the Division of Ag has been wonderful to work with on this, and I do believe that they're going to do everything they can to keep their costs down. The mission of the Division of Agriculture is not to put farmers out of business. And so even if the personnel would change there over time, that mission would stay. And so I think that there would not be the worry of it being such astronomical fees that it would put farmers out of business. But I will let that be a consideration of the committee, Mr. Chair.
I'll only defend it on this account. This is the second iteration of this bill, and you're asking that a Division of Agriculture to look down through history in a short notice. So maybe before we get this thing out of committee, they can give us their take on a different look at it. So I'm willing to bring that up. And there are going to be some other things that we'll be asking the department to look at that may actually change that. But we want to have close as we can to the truth and implementation as we can. So, other questions at this point? I think what we're going to do is lay the bill aside, and we'll bring it back up before us after you've had some conversation with your both your department and amongst yourselves, and we'll look and see what we can do to bring some of the issues before us in a committee substitute, in which case I'll have you once again introduce it to us from your perspective. Any other questions at this point, committee members? Thank you for joining us. Thank you all for your time, and we will stand adjourned at, looks like, 2:57.